From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Maybe I haven't told you before, but back in the 1980s, I was in a relationship with a Persian man. Obviously, we were of different cultures, but there was this cookbook that helped me communicate with his family, at least at the table. It's amazing how cookbooks have a way of doing that. The book was called Food of Life by Najmiye Butmonglij.
I wanted this middle-class school mates of my children to know about Persian culture and Persian New Year. And I want Iran associated with good things, rose petal, pomegranate, rice cookies.
That's Najmiye Butmonglij. She's the leading authority on Persian cuisine outside of Iran. She's been called the Grand Dame of Iranian cooking by the Washington Post. Last year, she published a book called Cooking in Iran, which is born of several return trips to Iran after decades of exile. Cooking in Iran is massive, gorgeous, and important. It was my favorite cookbook of 2018. Hi, Najmiye. I'm so glad you were able to come to Good Food.
Hi, Evan.
When you first came to the U.S., did you come with family?
No, the first time I came for the university. I was 18 years old.
And then you went back?
I went back after 7 years. I always loved cooking, but my mother wouldn't allow me in the kitchen. She always said, go to university, get your education. You will have plenty of time to cook. Then when I returned, I handed my master's degree to my mother, and she allowed me in her kitchen.
Because now it was time for you to find a husband.
I don't know about that, but it's a good reason. So I learned cooking actually from my mother after college degree.
And when you finally found yourself in exile, you and your husband were in France.
Yes, France, the climate, the crooked street, the aroma of wisteria and nostalgia of, you know, I wanted to connect with my roots, my past. So food was a healing process for me, actually. And then I started cooking for my neighbors, actually, my French neighbors. And
so as you developed and you spent more time away from Iran and you continued writing, where did you look to inspiration since you couldn't go back? Did you start to surround yourself with family and friends?
Yes, of course. You know that when I returned to Iran, I cooked with my mother. I record all the recipes she taught me. So I had a bunch of recipes with me, my mother's recipe. And then I started cooking, yes. Started cooking for friends at the beginning because there was no family around me. And then when we immigrated to America, the family started appearing at my doorsteps with the suitcase. So that's the story of all the immigrants, I guess. Then I start cooking for the family and then for friends. And then I, you know, during the Persian New Year, I always cooked cookies and I brought to the school. And so we celebrate Nowruz with the kids, American kids, because I thought a lack of education creates a lot of problem. I think American people should know more about these ethnic cultures. Knowledge is power.
How did the trips back to Iran, which allowed you to create this latest book, come about?
While I was writing all these cookbooks, you know, I wrote 6-7 cookbooks, and teaching Persian cooking and raising family outside of Iran in the U.S., I had this fantastic dream to go back to Iran, to travel throughout Iran, to meet its cooks, share kitchens, tables, to scent, to taste, to get a feeling of the situation in Iran and what really conveys the essence of Iran. That was very important for me. I always had this dream. So it took me 2 years of planning and 3 years of traveling. It was politically, logistically, and emotionally very scary because I did not have official permission from the government to take pictures.
I can imagine.
And so I was lucky. Friends and family helped me there.
Did you take all the pictures?
No. There was a very good photographer in Iran that was introduced to me, and he was willing to do that with me. Afshin Bakhtiar, he did the photos.
It's really extraordinary. I mean, the photos communicate so much and reinforce your work as a writer. So talk to me about those trips after so long. Did you feel like a daughter returning or like an outsider, or maybe both?
You know, I felt like an outsider, even though I lived in Iran to age of 18. I knew the language and culture. But when I went back to Iran, I could not function smoothly. I did not understand people's behavior and gestures. I had to decode their words and their gesture. I did not know the money has changed. Telephone system has changed. This Iran was different from what I had known before. So it wasn't easy.
There's a marvelous photo in the book of a tea house in the Tabriz Bazaar.
Yes.
There are older men are on one side of the room smoking hookahs, and younger men are on the other side on their cell phones.
That's right.
So you entered into a new place.
Different new places, yes. In Tabriz, that photograph, yes, is beautifully done.
So let's talk a little bit about food, because the food of this book, every page is incredible. So I would love to pick a town and look at the food just as an example. And I have to say that the huge number of fruit recipes that are savory and recipes that combine fruit and vegetables is really fascinating. So let's start with Hamadan.
Oh, Hamadan. One of the coldest and oldest places.
So tell us a bit about it. The recipes that you have, a beautiful pumpkin preserve, an apricot and nut pickle, roasted butternut squash with grape molasses.
Yes. You know that Hamadan, because it's so cold, there's a variety of preserve and pickles. And people, they use leftover bread, for example. They combine it with walnut and cheese and local herbs. They make a cheese meatball. Interesting things for me, when I traveled throughout Iran, I noticed that people, they don't know about each other. These Hamadani people, they didn't know the same food is made in Tabriz. They thought that's just this only Hamadani makes this dish. That was fascinating for me. I thought this book might create a communication even within Iran, which they didn't know about each other.
Talk to me about souring, because for me, it's one of the genius parts of the Persian kitchen.
That's true. In the, you know, the northern part of Iran, they use citrus, like they use lime, oranges, and because they had a wild pomegranate, they use a lot of pomegranate as a sour agent. In the middle of Iran, they use vinegar. I was impressed. They use vinegar and grape molasses, the combination of that, that make a fantastic sweet and sour. And of course, sumac juice and sumac. They use a lot of sumac. And I was impressed when they use sumac, they use touch of lime, squeeze touch of lime juice on the top too. So they create this fantastic sourness. In the southern Iran, by the Persian Gulf, they use tamarind. And they use tomato a lot because Portuguese came to Iran in 16th centuries. The influence of the tomatoes, because they brought tomato from the New World, and dry lime. That was one of my discoveries in the southern Iran. They use a lot of dry lime in so many forms. They use the heart of dry lime. They use the skin. They use the whole dry lime. And they marinate it. They make a kebab. They use it in the braise as a sour agent. So I was fascinated by that. And there was another thing that was fascinated was sesame. Sesame, they use this raw sesame, toasted sesame, toasted sesame oil, and they use tahini. In America, the tahini here is very thick. That was like a milk, very liquid tahini. And what was the best part? They make tahini cake. They call it halvardeh, which is tahini mixed with thick syrup of date juice. And then they add pistachio and almond and walnut. And that was the best, because I went to this artisanal workshop around the Persian Gulf, and every artisanal shops was inherited from their grandfather. It was two, three generations, they're making same thing in small, very small workshop. And the taste of their halva was so different from each other. So that was one of my discovery. And they cook fish in tahini. They make cake. They make cookies in tahini. So I'm very excited to experiment more with tahini these years.
I mean, this book is so monumental. How did you go through the process of taking notes while you were traveling?
I had my iPhone. I taped them. I taped the people while we were making it. I taped them, and I took some pictures, and I filmed some of them. Some of them were documented. I tried to do the dishes that I didn't know about. One of my interesting experience was at the port city of Bushehr by the Persian Gulf. My guide were married couple and university student. It really touched my heart because they were so respectful toward each other, and they were kind with one another. They were kind to me, and they went out of their way. They gave me so much of their time, the 3 days I spent with them. And they took us, when I say us, with my driver and my assistant and my photographer, she took us to her aunt's house, and her aunt taught me how to make the most cherished dish by Persian Gulf. Every region, they make this dish. They call qaliye mahi. Every region, they make it, and they claim theirs is the best, which is, you know, is a fish braised in cilantro, garlic, tamarind, and date. And they spice the fish. They make the sauce. Then they sear the fish. They usually use with the bones. I was very impressed because they like that idea. They cut the fish with their bones, and it's dusted, and they sear it, and they add it to the cilantro sauce. It was spicy, sweet and sour, and topped with the plain rice. That was my favorite dish. And I think the reason is, after all day of cooking, they took us to the backyard of a restaurant, and they serve us tea. They recite poetry of Omar Khayyam. I was astonished because the rest of Iran, they're obsessed with Hafez. In this region, they were obsessed with Khayyam, Omar Khayyam, which is well known in the West. And they recite poetry. They were playing music. So that was one of my best experience in that region.
Just listening to you talk about what it was like for you when you were there, there is such joy in your voice. And I have to tell you, that joy is transmitted this book.
Thank you. I really was overwhelmed. I was exhausted. I was scared, but I loved it.
Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
That was Najmieh Batmanglij talking to me about her cookbook, Cooking in Iran. I've written an essay about her and her important book on the Good Food blog. To read it, visit blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. In recent weeks, it's been unusually chilly and rainy here in LA. And when it's raining outside, I always find myself wanting nothing more than a big steaming bowl of hot broth with noodles.
I never sat down and said, I'm going to write about noodle soup. It kind of chose me as a topic.
That's Ken Albala. He's a noted food historian and prolific cookbook author. And you might call him a noodle soup fanatic. He made a different noodle soup every day for 2 years, which yielded a book. It's titled Noodle Soup, and it's filled with recipes that allow us to recreate his dishes in exacting detail. This is such an unexpected and interesting book.
Thank you.
How did those 2 years happen? Every day?
It was, well, every morning for breakfast. I was actually teaching at Boston University, and they gave me a nice apartment with a beautiful kitchen that had no utensils, not even a pot or a fork in it. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm not going to spend 6 weeks here without cooking, so I better do something. I bought a little pot at an Asian grocery store and saw ramen there and thought, I don't know, I'm sure I've tasted ramen, but I'd never really ate it consistently. And so I thought, all right, I'll have this for breakfast every day. And then suddenly started throwing vegetables and fish inside and sliced up chicken and things like that, and just got hooked. And I realized after a couple of months, I might as well write about this. I'm doing it every day. And then learned how to make pretty much every noodle that exists on Earth that I could find.
So did you do this sort of self-taught through the web and through books, or did you look for particular mentors for particular noodles?
Well, it was both. It was a combination of reading, looking on YouTube every now and then, but a lot of it was crowdsourced. I have a great group of friends on Facebook that I would say, oh, is there anyone here who's from Malaysia and cooks this? And then, of course, someone would chime in. And it's why there's pages of people I thank at the back.
So you're a food historian, so we have to talk about the birth of noodles. What is it as of today? Because I feel like it's like a changing target. Is it Italy, Greece, China?
Well, China has the best claim archaeologically. There's a bowl of noodle soup that was turned over in probably an earthquake or some natural disaster. And the noodles that were found in Lajia in China were made out of millet. And it's a crop that's actually indigenous there and just as important as rice. In fact, earlier than rice, it's cultivated. And the archaeologists looked at this thing and they tried to roll it out into a noodle, which, of course, it won't work. It's not, doesn't have the glutens in it that wheat does. So you have to extrude it. And it's some very simple kind of extrusion system. You'd squeeze the dough through little holes in a disc right into the liquid, which could be water, but probably was broth. Unfortunately, the moment they pulled the bowl out, the noodles disintegrated after 4,000 years.
How do we know that ancient peoples were making broth?
Well, there's actually pots that have residues of fat along the rims. And this is, again, an archaeological question, not a historical one. And they can basically tell from the residues on the rim whether they've broken open bones to boil them or whether there's fat in the pot, it'll float on top.
And are extruders pretty early?
I don't think there's much evidence of them because they would be made of wood. And all you really have to do is take a hollow piece of log, poke some holes in it, and then put a smaller log inside that larger one and squish the noodles out. So it's pretty simple as a mechanism.
Were early Chinese noodles made in a wide variety of shapes?
There probably were many, many shapes. I think, you know, people always argue, well, did they originate here and then spread somewhere else? And does this shape look like that shape? And I think anyone who grows a grain that you can make into a noodle, you're going to start playing with it, squeezing it into little lumps, rolling it between the palms of your hand into long threads. So I think, you know, in fact, if you ever give a lump of dough to a kid and say, here, make some noodles, you'll find a lot of shapes. And of course, they're, you know, they have different names wherever you go. And it doesn't necessarily mean they're connected. It just means that I think people independently discovered many, many shapes in many places.
Are noodles that are tubular, that have a hole, did that seem to be more Mediterranean focused?
Not necessarily. There are many ways to make those kinds of noodles. You can actually do it on an iron stiletto, like a pin, and then roll it out so that you have a hollow inside. It tends to be that nowadays most of them are extruded, so you have a kind of extruder that has a hole, a knob in the middle, so it comes out as a long tube, and then it's cut to make like a macaroni. But there are things in sort of the Middle East that are similar to that. I wouldn't say they're exclusive to Italy.
We could continue talking about history for a really long time, but let's move to the kitchen. So you were in this kitchen that you were going to be for a short period of time. And then when you went home, did you find that you started to acquire tools?
Well, I went a little crazy buying tools. I don't know how this happened. There are especially some beautiful Italian ones. There's the Torchio Ad Bigolare, which is a big bronze beast, basically, of an extruder, which I've seen references to it in Renaissance Italy, so I'm pretty sure it was invented right about there. And you could actually put a rock in there and make noodles out of it. It's so powerful. There's also the Troccolaturo, which I love just saying that, but it's basically a rolling pin made of bronze that has very sharp ridges on it. So you just roll it over the pasta and it cuts the whole thing out. So there's beautiful tools, you know, whole variety of steamers and cutters and little paddles for shaping things like gnocchi.
So let's talk a bit about dough textures. How many different kinds of textures did you sort of investigate and what makes them unique?
Well, the dough texture is kind of important, depending on what you want in the end. Some noodles you can just keep adding flour to, and you want something that's really hard that you're going to roll out and cut into sort of broad egg noodles. That's the kind of dough you want. Some you have to keep adding water, which is weird. So if you want to do a pulled noodle, you just get as much water into it as you can as you're kneading it for a really long time, for like a half an hour. So the textures of noodles, unlike bread, which, you know, there's a fairly limited range where the bread will either be so stiff it's not going to rise or so wet it's just going to flop apart. A noodle, really, you can go from a completely wet dough that you extrude or pull and then boil to one that's really, really hard. But the truth is, actually, if you're boiling them, any texture is going to work fine. As long as you can get it into the noodle shape you want and throw it in the water, you stop it when it's done and then eat it.
What about alkaline noodles?
Well, this is another difficult question. There are some forms of this, like the powder pengui, which are used to create that slippery texture. And you find it also in Filipino pancit, which are slightly yellowish. Many pulled noodles use it also. And I have found that it kind of burns your tongue like a, you know, anything that's really super alkaline, unless you use the absolute tiniest amount of it. And apparently the origin of this is in China, where they had an alkaline water that they used, and it does loosen the dough, so it makes it much easier to pull. And I found that it's really not necessary, and I think it's so easy to overdo it at home that if I use it, I use like a scant quarter of a teaspoon in a whole batch of dough.
Did you teach yourself to hand pull?
I kind of did. I spoke with a handful of people, including the people who work for Martin Yan, which was really nice. And I watched a lot of, you know, you can look at these videos on YouTube. What they don't explain to you is that putting water in the noodle is absolutely important. And then letting it rest for at least 6 hours is also really important. And after that point, it's really easy to pull. Now, the whole dance that, you know, you've seen people twist it around and jump up in the air and pull and get these infinitely minute threads out of it, that's really, really hard to do. I can get close. I can, you know, get it up to a certain thread count, but I don't think it's important to do. And in fact, the recipe that I give in this book is basically to roll out the dough, cut it into strips, and then pull each one individually. And then you don't have to worry about twisting or turning or dancing around or it sticking together, which often happens too.
What was the most challenging, time-intensive bowl of noodles that you've made so far?
Well, some of them, you know, have lots of different parts that you put together. And I think the technique that I think I sort of invented uses the microwave, actually. And it's using a starch noodle that is extruded from a piping bag onto a Silpat mat and then microwave for about a minute and then scraped up and boiled. And that's a really, really easy way to make rice noodles, but not quite as labor intensive as taking dried ingredients, dehydrating them, grinding them, and then adding them back to the noodles.
Like what?
I did it actually with a whole salad. So every single ingredient in the salad, the carrots, the cucumbers, the lettuce, the tomatoes, I sliced up, dehydrated, ground, put it into separate doughs, and then reconstructed the whole thing. So it looks like the colors of salad. And what's neat about it is the flavors are really, really intense. You get much more than, like, you know, a commercially, like a spinach pasta or something, which may have, you know, 2% spinach for coloring. You can even get more than 50% of the vegetable. And in some cases, like I was trying for years and years to get a good artichoke noodle, like with really intense artichoke flavor. And it turns out if you slice baby artichokes really thin, dehydrate and grind and put them in, you get a noodle that looks, tastes, smells exactly like artichoke, that you can put in artichoke broth and garnish with artichoke and just, you know, blow your head off, basically.
Wow. You made a Cheeto noodle.
I did. This, you know, I got carried away, I guess, and went a little overboard. And I thought, you know, anything that exists, I want to see if I can put it into a noodle. And the cool thing about Cheetos is that when you crush them up and add them to a dough and extrude them, they come out looking like Cheetos again, like just because of the chemicals and stuff. And floating around in a soup, really kind of interesting and diverting, I would say.
Of all the broths, what is the one that you think is the most versatile that you present?
Chicken broth is pretty versatile, but I would say the one that I have come to really love is a good dashi stock, and that is almost instant. I mean, it takes just, you know, 5 or 10 minutes to make. It's the preparation of the ingredients that go into it that's really long, and I've just come to adore that broth. I mean, it's like a cornerstone of Japanese cuisine, and it is 8,000 times better than the instant dashi broth.
Well, you have presented us with a book that is so informative, has so many odd and quirky little sidebars in it I just can't wait to really read every single word.
Well, the object is to get you in the kitchen making noodles because people are intimidated by it for some reason or think you need a lot of machines and a lot of expertise. And I swear, you know, the best thing that happens is when I have a group of kids or someone's teaching a cooking class with children and they say, we used your recipe and it worked fine. It was easy. And that just, you know, goes to show that you don't need a lot of time or expertise. It's really simple.
I've been talking with Ken Albala about his book, Noodle Soups: Recipes, Techniques, Obsession. He's a professor of history at the University of the Pacific and founder of the Food Studies MA program in San Francisco. Maybe you've been hearing some chatter about natural wine, and maybe you've been wondering, what's all the big fuss? After the break, a visit to the world's largest natural wine fair. Stick around.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleinman. Now for something a little different. It's a dispatch on natural wine from Richard Parks III. Richard is a friend of Good Food. He's the co-author of the Gorilla Tacos Cookbook and the man behind Richard's famous food podcast, a gastro comedy show. In the most recent episode of his podcast, Richard visited Raw Wine, the world's biggest natural wine fair, which recently came to L.A. Raw Wine the Fair champions anti-commercial wines made with minimal intervention. For this episode, Richard invited a friend along to Raw, whom you might recognize as KCRW's own David Weinberg. Take it away, Richard.
It's Richard's Famous Food Podcast.
Do you think we should be in character for any of this?
I don't do well as a character. I mean, you could be a character.
This is my friend David Weinberg, the award-winning podcaster and radio producer, and me, standing outside of Raw Wine. After receiving an assignment to cover the fair for this podcast, I was faced with an immediate dilemma. I couldn't possibly fathom the idea of holding a microphone while twirling a yeasty skin contact wine in my custom crystal stem glass, so I'd invited David to help me produce this episode.
Come on, let's jump into the brine!
And to my delight, he said,
yes! Hoping that I could be referred to throughout the day as just your intern.
Okay, intern.
But seriously,
actually,
I'm amply chuffed to have David's help. He's like the punk rock Studs Terkel of contemporary podcasting.
Aww.
He makes stories about hobos, dreamers, and outsiders with true empathy, casting them as heroes in their own minds. Given these bona fides, I'd say a promotion from intern to producer is well-deserved. Anyways, me on the other hand, I'm just a white-collar fine audio food journalist with a vanity podcast project and a fancy soundboard.
Actually,
the stage is set for a perfect collaboration. There's just one problem.
To be perfectly honest, I'm not that interested in natural wine. I don't have a lot of interest in it.
So on this episode of Richard's Famous, I'm going to have to convince David of the merits of natural wine.
Natural Weinberg.
Which shouldn't be too hard, because natty wine is the best. Instead of using additives for color and flavor, plus stuff like sulfur, natural winemakers don't mess with their grapes. During the winemaking process, nothing is added, nothing is taken away. The results are magical. Flavors can be seductively smoky, funky, yeasty. Colors range from amber to pink lemonade, and each and every bottle is special. Plus, natural wine has an ethos. It's anti-commercial, DIY, iconoclastic. But first, to get inside, we gotta get past this imposing-looking security guard wearing a suit and wraparound sunglasses. A soul-patched sentry standing at the gates of natural wine, his bald head gleaming in the L.A. sun.
You wanna do an interview?
Yeah.
What's
your name?
Nate.
What type of characters have you seen walking in today?
Some foreigners with, like flashy clothing.
I mean, you look pretty sly.
I mean, I'm fresh, but, like, I'm talking about flashy, like silk and like this one dude had like a sparkly leopard thing with like tattoos on his neck. They got a couple characters. They got some chicks. They got some dudes. You know what I'm saying? Whatever you like, I'm sure you can find something in there.
Any troublemakers so far?
Hell no. They know better. Look at me. The wise words of the great little John, don't start no there won't be no
They had like a brass knuckles or something.
I got two hands and a fighting chance. They ain't gonna touch me. Wish you would try. Bring them out, son. What you gonna do? I ain't scared.
Like wine?
Yeah, I drink it. I'm not gonna put it in my mouth and then spit it in a bucket, though. I'm gonna drink it. Where I'm from, we drink it.
What's your name again?
Nate.
Nate, thanks,
nice
man.
Nice to meet you, bro.
Yeah, take it easy.
Are you planning to spit?
Yeah, I don't wanna, like, ruin my day tomorrow.
All right,
this is intimidating.
Here.
This is intimidating.
We've moved up into this sort of cavernous space. Let's say there are easily a couple hundred people here already.
In L.A., where 10 years ago there were none, there are now more than a half dozen natural wine-focused shops, plus dedicated bars and restaurants with natural wine-exclusive lists. What started as a small underground movement has blossomed into a full-on trend, and no trend would be complete without...
Actually, we're wine influencers. My friend, she actually created National Orange Wine Day. It was like... the dopest party. I had like 12 skin contact wines.
We start at the beginning with wines from the Republic of Georgia.
What is present day Georgia is probably where humans domesticated the grapevine.
By some accounts, that was as many as 10,000 years ago. And to this day, Georgian wines are made in an old style, fermented in large earthenware vessels shaped like turnips called quevri or amphorae, often stored underground during the winemaking process. And whereas most commercial white wines are fermented after skins are removed, many of Georgia's white wine grapes are fermented with the skins on. This is what's meant when wines are described as skin contact, that's the skin of the grape, not wine you touch, or alternatively, orange, that's the color, not the fruit.
Did you notice we're not spitting out our wine?
You shouldn't spit out Georgian wines.
I'm having a ball. David, on the other hand...
Do you feel like you have a sense of what is good about natural wine?
No. It's like binary for me. It's like... I like it or I don't.
Like it or not, you have to appreciate natural wine at least for its novelty.
Bat is an old school fertilizer that used to be used in churches a lot.
Is using bat as a fertilizer, is that accepted and you can still call your wine natural wine?
Yeah, why not? I mean,
I don't know. I don't know much about natural wine.
Yeah, we've heard about that, David. Many natural winemakers say their farming practices are what distinguish their wines. But what is natural wine after all?
It's not so well defined.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to drink.
Okay.
Organic farming,
huh.
Minimal intervention in their vineyards,
got it.
Biodynamic,
uh-huh.
Something lunar.
Of course.
It's good for health.
Clearly.
We're suggesting that you ask where your wine is coming from.
Yep, yep.
No additives in the cellar. No. It's structured.
Uh-huh.
The actual term is acetyl tetrahydropyridy.
Fruité.
Mm. Yeah.
Opulence.
Sure.
Smashable.
Wait, what?
Natural wine. Yeah.
Some say that natural wine is becoming little more than a pose.
A lot of people are here for Instagram or because they want to be trendy, and that's not what natural's about.
Maybe I'm part of the problem here. Just another game-sipping, trend-chasing, gastro-comedy podcast-making dilettante. Come on, Parks. Come on.
Actually, anyways.
What is it about? I need David to figure out. And the only way to learn is to taste.
Do we do like micro-fermentation? Direct press Saporavi?
Oh, Slovakia.
Is winemaking part of the Mittelstand?
I want to let my intern ask you a question.
How did you get assigned the spit bucket duty?
All right, we're going to get some wine.
The thing about me is like when they start talking about wine, I just kind of like tune out.
I'm like, oh, okay, I get it. Grapes, wine, whatever. You're only an intern at a food podcast.
Anyways.
After 27 more glasses of wine, we meet Louis Dixon, a trial lawyer turned natural winemaker from Texas's hill country.
I've got a wine that I call Shango Naranja Fabulosa. Shango is a nickname that I was given by Billy Gibbons and ZZ Top. We got a buddy's truck, and we had a steel cage welded, and we would strap ourselves into the cage, and then we'd get going about 100 miles an hour and then push the cage out. Billy was the first one to go, and so he wrote a song called Master of Sparks, and it's about the cage flying out of the back of that truck. In fact, there's a line in the song, it was like a stick of rolling dynamite, which it was. You listen to that song, Master of Sparks, that's a true story. And actually, when we pulled him out of that cage, the back of his neck and arms were all burned from the sparks. So when we tried it, we wrapped ourselves in wet towels so we wouldn't get burned. It was crazy.
Is this the moment when things start to get ugly?
Yes.
I think that we've reached the non-spitting portion of the evening.
I mean, you can see the place transforming into more of a bar.
A group of drunken natural wine scenesters descends on our microphone.
I want you to like explicitly tell me what verbally is it that you guys are about? What is your position? What is your stance? What is your political or not? Like
food, what is it?
Somehow we managed to break away and run into Nate, the security guard.
How you doing?
Any troublemakers?
I only had one issue. Can people bring in the kids in here? You seen the dude with like the little baby on his chest, like the hangover? I'm like, bruh, this lady asked me, she said, hey, you could watch my car? I said, for what? She said, my kid's in there. You got two kids in there? You didn't even crack the windows? I was like, I ain't letting you in. But other than that, I'm just like, all right, I feel bad that y'all paying me for this. Like, I ain't even doing nothing. I'm just standing here with a bald head.
I pull David outside to debrief on what he's learned about natural wine, but he seems fixated on the Texas winemaker with the ZZ Top story.
I want to do a story about that guy. I want to go down to Texas. I want to hang out with him.
No. You're coming here as an RFFP intern, and you're producing this episode.
We never actually talked about what the agreement was here.
I managed to wrest the microphone out of David's hands.
Intern.
Oh, but he's not holding the microphone right now. Why are you so afraid of like taking chances and changing things?
I think I have to go to my family. I'm going to stop. We're done.
So it's the day after the wine fair, and I don't know what to do.
David don't like that natty wine. Though his internship was fine.
I know.
Richard?
Yeah.
Hey, what's up, brother? It's Nate.
Rock your body, mic check.
I'm just putting this thing together, and you sound really good on tape.
Oh, thanks, man.
You know, I have this podcast, and I was wondering if maybe you'd want to get involved.
Absolutely.
All right, cool.
Absolutely, I'm down with that.
You could be, like, the producer of an episode.
Okay, hell yeah. Baby, I'ma drop it down to the ground, then put it in your face now. What you gonna do? You guys do a food podcast?
Yeah.
All right, well, perfect. I'll eat whatever.
It's Richard's Famous Food Podcast.
Many thanks to Richard Parks III for sharing his episode of Richard's Famous Food Podcast. To hear a longer version of this story and for more gastro-comedy fun, subscribe to his show wherever you get your podcasts and follow on Twitter and Instagram, of course, at Richard's Famous. Look for the icon of the mustachioed pickle. Humans have been using natural processes to make wine and beer for eons, but what do we really know about what they tasted like? And what if we could recreate them today?
So if you have a bunch of hunter-gatherers, you know, out working and hunting and gathering up their different grains, you know, they're going to be tired at the end of the day. And if they can make a fermented beverage, you know, all the better. It breaks down the inhibitions, you know, between the group.
Pat McGovern is a biomolecular archaeologist who's particularly interested in what the ancients drank. You might call him the Indiana Jones of ancient ales and extreme beverages. He's written a book on the subject called Ancient Brews. Hi, Dr. Pat.
Hello, Evan. How are you doing?
I'm so excited to talk to you. I love your work. Let's explain to people exactly what you do. What conditions provide the best samples for you?
Okay, well, now we look for the best preserved samples that we possibly can find. And of course, in archaeology, it's a destructive process. I mean, to begin with, you know, you don't have a lot of organic material that sticks around. You have inorganic material like pottery and so forth. But we're interested in what goes inside the pottery. And that's the organic material, the foods, beverages, and so forth. So then the archaeological process itself, you know, you only recover a very small percentage. So the best contexts in which we can get samples from are like out in the desert where there's very little humidity that's going to break down the organic samples, or up on the Alps like the Iceman that was pulled out maybe 10 or 20 years ago and has undergone a lot of analyses, or in bogs like you'd find in northern Europe where there's very little oxygen, or even at the bottom of a place like the Black Sea, which is down thousands of feet. And then we look for samples that have not been disturbed secondarily. So, you know, like a tomb that has been covered over, like the Midas tomb that was the first one that we worked on from central Turkey. I mean, that was like a hermetically sealed chamber in which the king had been buried.
That must have been like just heaven for you.
It was, because they brought the samples back to the University of Pennsylvania Museum in the case of the Midas tumulus, and they sat there just waiting 30 years or so until I was told that the samples were still in the original paper bags that they had originally been collected in. And I just had to, it was like the easiest excavation I was ever on. I just had to walk up two flights of stairs, and there the samples were from 1957, and we could just start the analyses right away.
So when do you find the earliest evidence of consumption in the ancient world?
You mean in terms of beverages?
Yes.
Because, you know, foods and so forth are the other issue, and you know, how early was cooking practiced? And we have situations like with hominids in the Olduvai Gorge, where one hominid seems to be eating another hominid and throwing the bones over their shoulders so that they form a nice, neat circle around the ones that are eating. I think the earliest probable beverage is from Egypt, going back 18,000 years ago. Where we do have a site in the eastern desert of Egypt that, you know, had good remains. And it was used in our Ta Hanket recreation. So you had different kinds of palm dates and herbs and what have you that would have gone into a concoction from about that period. Now, recently they've found in Israel and Jordan what they claim is the earliest beer and bread, which goes back 12,000 years ago. So once we get back into the Paleolithic, even though it goes millions of years and represents 99% of human history, the preservation is very poor. And so we have to wait until pottery is invented and get absorption of liquids into the pottery to be able to really do these kinds of analyses. Unfortunately, pottery wasn't invented until around 6,000 BC. So once we start digging back into the Paleolithic period, we really don't have a lot to go on.
During the course of your research, you must have given quite a bit of thought to the question of why we drink.
Oh, yeah. I've given a lot of thought to that. And, of course, I've also had to do a lot of modern experimentation to find out, you know, what's involved in drinking. Yeah, I mean, I think it's in our genes, basically. And it goes back millions of years ago. It's, you know, part and parcel of what life on this planet is. I mean, fermentation is probably the earliest energy system on the planet, going back 4 billion years. It's even in the inebriation genes that we have that go by names like barfly and amnesiac and happy hour and so forth. The same genes are found in the fruit fly and many insects. Genetically, we're really set up to drink. And then socially, we also, it breaks down the barriers, you know, between individuals in a group. And it's a medicine. You know, alcohol is safer for you than drinking raw water. And alcohol also is an energy provider because 10% of the enzymes in our liver can convert alcohol into energy.
I imagine you in a lab doing the kind of work that you do. At what point do you start to, in your head, create a flavor profile of what you're making?
Well, this is where I have to really depend a lot on the experimental brewer. Like at Dogfish Head, the owner and main brewer is Sam Calagione, who's kind of a rock star in the brewing industry, you know, for being so inventive. And he has like a fine sensibility of, you know, how these things might work together. And I make my suggestions. Like, for instance, on the Midas drink, we had a competition among microbrewers to see who could come up with the best interpretation of that. For a recreation that we did of the Midas funerary feast back in 2000. And I suggested to Sam that we couldn't use hops because hops are only 700 AD and the Midas tomb is back at 700 BC. But we could use something like saffron, which would be the color of the residues that we analyzed. Now, we never identified exactly whether it was saffron, but Turkey was famous for its saffron, and that turned out to produce a beautiful tasting beverage. I mean, he used the best saffron they could find, and it turned out to be the most expensive beer he ever made, but then it did win more tasting awards than any other Dogfish Head brews, so I think the investment was worthwhile.
It must be fascinating for you to work in a field that has such a direct through line between ancient and modern. You're in touch with something that's so human.
Yeah, I mean, it touches, you know, everybody, the history of fermented beverages, especially if you're sort of bringing it back to life again. You know, so it's like a liquid time capsule that you're producing. I mean, you're learning about how, you know, our ancestors basically were very innovative and discovered these techniques long ago, and also were, you know, going through their environment looking for different herbs and so forth that go into solution in alcohol and make it even more medicinally effective. But, you know, if you only had 20 or 30 year lifespan, you know, you'd be on the lookout for any kind of herb, tree resin or whatever that, you know, might help to prolong your life, reproduce more and so on, you know, cure disease. It's very exciting in that way because it sort of brings the past into the present and it has positive results that it can lead to, not just, you know, giving you a high, you know, the mind-altering experience, but different flavors and aromas and so forth that you might never know about.
What other ancient brews have you had a hand in developing?
I mentioned briefly the Egyptian one called Tahankit, but we've done ones for Italy, like an early Etruscan beverage going back to 800 BC that has pomegranates, hazelnuts, rosemary, and so forth. We did one for Scandinavia that was quite interesting because there, going back to 3000 BC, they are, you know, in an area that's sort of right at the limits of civilization. And so they have their own natural products up there. So we had to use things like bog cranberry, lingonberry, what are called the groot types of herbs, bog myrtle, birch resin. I guess the most interesting one from my point of view is the one from China, which is called Jiahu, Chateau Jiahu, because it's the earliest alcoholic beverage we ever analyzed and recreated. So that goes back to 7000 BC. It was hawthorn tree fruit and a wild grape from China and honey and then rice because you're in China. Now, if you go over to the Midas beverage in the Middle East, which is much later, 700 BC, there you've got barley, but you also have honey and you've got the Eurasian grape, which produces most of the wine that we drink today. You know, I should also say, as far as the other recreations, we've also done the New World. So we've made a chocolate beverage that's some of the earliest chemical evidence for chocolate from Honduras called Theobroma. We did even distilled beverages made from different fruits in Mexico, not just agave, but other fruits that are native to that area. So, you know, we've got a lot on our plate at the moment.
Thank you so much for taking the time for us.
Nice talking to you, Evan.
That's Patrick McGovern, Scientific Director of the Biomolecular Archaeology Project for Cuisine, Fermented Beverages, and Health at the University of Pennsylvania Museum. We've been talking about his book, Ancient Brews, Rediscovered and Recreated. After the break, our friend Laura Avery. Stay with us. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Finally, the Market Report. Take us out of here, Laura.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're coming up on Valentine's Day, and people love to shop for loved ones here at the Farmers Market. Of course, we do it every week, all year round. So happy now to be catching up with Akasha Richman, who started Akasha Restaurant in Culver City, back when Culver City was kind of kind of a little bit of out-of-the-way backwater, and she's holding down a central location in Culver City at Akasha Restaurant. Additionally, she's opened up AR Cucina, which is kind of a passion project. It's an Italian restaurant adjacent to Akasha. And Akasha, you're here. You're shopping for some ingredient that you will be serving on Valentine's Day. Can you talk about what you're shopping for?
Well, I'm looking at all the citrus, especially blood oranges. Because Valentine's Day, I always think red, pink, color, and blood oranges are red, and they pair so nicely with so many things. I mean, not just dessert. We're doing it at Akasha with a Dungeness crab salad with some beautiful lettuce that we'll get at the Garden of. They have those beautiful little red leaf lettuces, so many different kinds that I love, love, love. And then over at AR Cucina, we're doing some pan-seared scallops with blood orange and mint. And I have this stash of olive oil that's just been pressed in November 2018. So it's really green and really fresh, and I use it at both restaurants for specials like this.
Italian olive oil?
It's Italian olive oil. I have some from Tuscany. I have some from Sicily. And of course, Sicily and blood orange is also a pretty good pairing there.
So when you when you open a blood orange, they have different levels of redness inside. Do you go for the variegated ones? Do you know in advance what you're going to be cutting into? Or do you just kind of take a chance?
Well, I like to taste everything before I use it. You know, I tasted one the other day that someone brought me, and it was so sour. I mean, it was great if you really want those sour notes, but I want it a little sweeter for Valentine's Day, a little richer in flavor.
There's two or three different kinds of blood oranges. I know there's a Moro, and then there's another one and another one. I'm not sure if you go by variety, or do you just go by farmer?
I go by farmer.
The best way
so
to go.
We have such great farms. I mean, we have Peter Shaner, and we have Murray Farms, and Garcia, and J.J. Sloan. I mean, there's so many nice varieties here, so I like to try everything. They're so pretty.
How are you peeling them and getting them into these dishes?
Well, I also like to use everything. So sometimes we take the zest off, and we'll use it in a macaroon, or we'll use it in a cake, or we'll preserve it, you know, candy it. So we like to use everything. And then, you know, we peel them and section them and
scrape all the white stuff off.
Take the pith off, of course.
Right. You mentioned that blood oranges and olive oil are Sicilian or common to Sicily.
Well, in Sicily, they grow blood oranges and they're unbelievable. Yeah. They do a fabulous salad with blood orange and fennel and black olives and a couple other things if you want. That's just incredible.
Right. And you travel a lot. You go to Bali a lot.
Now, I've only been to Bali once. I have a family in Sardinia. My daughter's father is from a small village of 2,500 people, and it's the most incredible village that you can't even get to by train. You have to drive or take a bus from the nearest train station. So we drive. And, you know, Uncle Johnny also produces olive oil. I have an uncle that makes wine, olive oil. They have goats. They make cheese. So I'm going to use a few of those things for Valentine's Day, too, because I bring all this stuff back and I have to use it.
Yeah.
It's not fun just to keep it for yourself.
No.
I want to share.
So Valentine's Day, we're getting into Akasha's secret stash. This is very exciting.
We are. We are. I even have a piece of cheese from Sardinia.
Wow.
That's amazing. You got to come by and
come
try
by.
Some. It's the goats eat a special berry that grows wild, and they live off that, and it's known for longevity. And my daughter brought me back a half a wheel on her last trip.
Oh, that sounds so exciting. So close to the land.
Yeah, very close to the land.
Good. Yeah. Akasha, thank you for the inspiration. Thank you for being here. And look forward to the Valentine's menu.
Me too.
That was Akasha Richmond. She is chef owner of Akasha Restaurant and AR Cucina Restaurants in Culver City, kind of holding down the central location right in the epicenter of the gorgeous downtown area of Culver City. And always so happy to see her here at the market. Farmer Peter Shaner from Valley Center is one of the many farmers here who grows blood oranges. In fact, I think Akasha is going to be using your blood oranges for her Valentine menu. Can you tell us what variety you grow, why you grow them, and overall how you like them and how your customers like them?
We grow the Moro variety. Basically, we grow them because that is the orange for the winter season. Valencias, you're running out of Valencias. In fact, if we are able to hold back a few Valencias, they're really, really sweet. And if you mix it with the blood orange juice, which is tart, it's very nice juice. The blood orange juice, and later on in this, its season, will get sweet also. So it's the orange of preference for the wintertime.
And your fruit, the way you grow your fruit, or your boy, you bring it here, it hangs on the tree until you harvest it and bring it to market. They are not picked at one stage and then stored.
Correct. The longer the fruit stays on the tree, the sweeter it gets. And once you pick it, it's not going to get any sweeter. If that's the amount of sugar it has, is what it has. So the longer we can leave it on the tree, the better it is for sweetness.
So you try to leave, I can imagine, you pick as few as you can at the beginning.
Correct.
And then let all the sweet stuff come later.
And then also, too, with the blood orange, it gets darker with time also. Especially now with these cold nights, that brings the color out.
So you're kind of in mid-season right now. We're in February.
Yeah.
How long do you think they're going to last? I mean, when are we going to get the sweet stuff?
Well, they're very good and edible right now.
Uh-huh.
And if they're not sweet, it does not mean that they don't taste good. They have a very complex flavor. Mm-hmm. There's more to their flavor than just the sweetness. And they'll last, we could hold them till May or June.
Okay, on the tree.
On the tree.
Okay.
But if our markets demand us to pick them faster, then we pick them faster.
Right. That's what's so great about being in such close contact with your customers.
Yeah.
You kind of can gauge how many to bring and how many you're going to sell.
Yeah. But the story of how we got blood oranges is pretty interesting. In the Bible, Joseph, the man with many colored coats, was sold into slavery in Potiphar's court by his brothers, and he was very, very good looking, and he was running through the garden, Potiphar's garden, and Potiphar's wife and her mistresses cut their hand as they were peeling oranges because they were so engrossed with Joseph's beauty. So that may not be exactly how we got blood oranges, but that at least tells you how old the fruit is. It's a very old fruit. It's been around a long time.
And this was in, where was he exiled? Was that Egypt? Was that, where was that?
In Egypt.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, this is so fascinating, and we'll check them out and peel them and have fun enjoying the flavors. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Farmer Peter Shaner. He is from Valley Center, California. He grows quite a variety of citrus. You can also find things like shallots and stinging nettles, and he's one of our longtime farmers here, so do check him out and say hello. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
That's it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And as always, leave us a review if you like the show. My thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laryl Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Abby Swanson and Kenny Ng for their help. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.